Good morning and welcome to Jump in Tucson. I am your host, Dr. Ed Ackerley, and with me as a co-host today is Sixto Molina. Good morning, Sixto.
Good morning, Dr. Ed.
Well, you and I like to eat. We like to go places and have good food and talk and have a good experience. And I've been teaching down at the U of A for 33 years now, almost 34, and have had a lot of good experience at the University of Arizona Dining. I was just at one of their fine restaurants just the other day with a group of people celebrating someone's promotion. It was great. So we are speaking this segment with Christine Carlson, who happens to be the Director of Dining and Nutrition at the University of Arizona Student Union. So how are you doing, Christine?
I'm good. How are you?
Great. So before we get talking about the University of Arizona Student Union and all the wonderful things that are going on there, let's talk a little bit about Christine. So how did you, what's your trajectory? How did you become a person that is knows something a little bit about dining and nutrition, and how did you get to the University of Arizona?
Yeah, so I started about 10 years ago. I started as assistant director for nutrition. I'm actually a registered dietitian. Mm-hmm. And so I was the first ever registered dietitian to work in dining. And so kind of had a blank canvas, grew a lot of different programming and continued to grow. I now oversee all of the dining concepts on campus. So over 30 restaurants on campus, as well as the dining nutrition efforts that we have.
What I've noticed over the last 30 plus years is the kind of metamorphosis of what the offerings are from maybe back many years ago, maybe a little bit more of a fast foodish kind of an approach to things, to where now it's pretty obvious that there is a pretty big focus on health and nutrition and feeding students well so that they can go navigate through the academic process in a powerful way.
Yes, we're always looking to see what's trending, what students are looking for, and we have that ability to kind of flip menus or restaurants around to create those experiences that students are looking for.
I've also noticed that the students themselves are a lot more focused on their own health, you know, with the big rec center and the physical fitness focus that they have, but also just in the classroom itself, you know, maybe 25, 30 years ago, they'd come in. Of course, they didn't have those beautiful water bottles that they have now, but they would come in and they would have, a soft drink or something. But now they come in many times, they've got water in there, and they are heading to the workout place afterwards. And even over at the Honors College, there's a big workout facility that they've put in, and there's a lot more focus on physical fitness and health and nutritional fitness as well.
Yes, I've definitely noticed that as well. We actually, you mentioned physical fitness. We created a program several years ago called Eat Like a Champ. And CHAMP is an acronym that stands for carbohydrate, hydration, anti-inflammatory, mental focus, and protein. And the idea behind it is that we're training students to kind of try and eat the full CHAMP. Each letter has foods that have those functions. And we created different things like the CHAMP smoothie that's available at IQ Fresh in the Student Union Food Court. We have CHAMP bars available at Enrich Urban Market. But then we also talk to students about, you know, kind of what they're up to. They might choose different letters. So if they're an endurance athlete, they might be looking more at C and H, carbohydrate and hydration. If they're injured, they might be looking more at anti-inflammatory or protein. Or if they're having trouble, you know, concentrating in the classroom, they might focus more on the mental focus.
Right. You know, I'd even noticed this in the the vending machines that just as a general rule, the vending machines that are, you know, made available to students and faculty and staff, you know, again, 30 years ago, they would be chock full of sugary products and pick-me-ups kind of thing. But now, even the vending machines, well over half of them are more nutritional and focus, or whatever you would say, nutritional, I guess. And then even the drinks that you can get out of the vending machines, not all of them are necessarily sugary products. There's a lot of other options, waters and other things that are available.
And we work with those companies to request those types of things, and they're very interested in making sure that they're giving the students what they want.
You know, we'll talk a little bit about the different things that you do at the Student Union, but when Scott Button was there several years ago, at one point he said that the University of Arizona is one of the biggest purveyors of daily meals for food in the state of Arizona. That comes mainly because there's so many locations of the University of Arizona as a land-grant institution. with locations all over the state of Arizona, you know, whether it be a farm up in the Four Corners area or wherever. There's a lot of food service facilities that the University of Arizona oversees, which you folks oversee most of those. It's a pretty daunting task every day to feed as many people as you feed.
Yeah, we probably serve about 5 million meals a year.
That's amazing.
And it obviously takes a lot of people to do that. So we do have a production kitchen, we have a central warehouse, and we have a lot of staff, obviously. We mm-hmm. have our chefs, our cooks, our managers, sanitation, warehouse help as well, just to make sure all of that happens. We have, we're the largest employer of students on mm-hmm. the university campus. And a lot of, you know, one of the things we really like to do is try and offer an experiential learning for students. So students have the option to grow into student lead positions where they are kind of the person in charge during some off hour times. Mm-hmm. And one of my favorite things is that we have some students that are interested in growing with us and becoming career staff. And so we have students that are still attending classes and are career staff, but then we also have some folks that started as students, went into a student lead, and now are managers for us.
Do you engage at all with the campus food bank that is on campus, the campus pantry?
We do.
Are you engaged with that process?
Yeah. We do. And we have a program where we do work with them and offer refrigeration and donations mm-hmm. for them as well.
We're going to bring them in on a future show and talk about the campus pantry and that whole nutrition perspective of, you know, it goes all the way back to years ago, even during the civil rights and you know, individual rights in our communities in the 60s and 70s, that free and reduced lunches and breakfasts now all came about because the whole theory that if a student is not well fed and have good nutrition, a little guy in kindergarten and first grade is not going to know 2 + 2 or ABCs if they're hungry. And the same thing bodes well for the student at the University of Arizona. They have to have good nutrition in order for them to engage with that academic process.
Yeah, absolutely. We actually have a rooftop garden at the Student Union Memorial Center where we collaborate with College of Agriculture, and they harvest tomatoes, bell peppers, cucumbers, and those are all donated to the campus pantry. Anything that can't be used, we'll go ahead and produce in our production kitchen and use in our restaurants, but it's for the students that are attending the campus pantry.
Do you know if the county law has been changed yet? Like California, it has. I know. I'm not sure what it is here. So, like, for instance, when you have a big catering event and there's leftover food, are you allowed to donate that yet? Or does that not able to go to kitchens and so forth?
We are able to donate that, provided that it meets health codes as far as temperature and how long it's been sitting.
Right.
We do have a program called Boxing Up Hunger where that food is blast chilled and portioned into single portions so that students can get that as well as at the campus pantry.
Excellent. When we come back after the break, we'll talk a little bit more about some exciting things that are going on and the future of technology in delivering food all across campus. You're listening to Jump in Tucson on KVOI 1030 AM The Voice. We'll be back after a few words from our great sponsors. Welcome back to Jump in Tucson. This is Dr. Ed Ackerley. Today is the Wonder Day, where we talk about the good things going on at the University of Arizona. My co-host this morning is Sixto Molina. Good morning again, Sixto.
Good morning, Dr. Ed. Happy to be here.
With us is Christine Carlson. She's the Director of Dining and Nutrition at the University of Arizona Student Unions, serving almost 5 million meals, did you say a year?
A year.
That's a lot of meals that go out from the
Food.
Student Union kitchens. Yeah.
Yes.
Amazing. Well, let's talk about a little bit about some of those venues that are available both in the Student Union and other satellite locations. You talked about 30 different restaurants, but tell us how those all came about and how you've varied the distribution of food, and instead of just all coming to a buffet where you walk down the line with your student tray like you did in high school, to
sure.
all the cool things that have come about in the last few years.
Sure. So we do have 4 all you care to eat or cafeteria style locations available on campus. One of those is one that we just built out last year. It's called Radicchio. It is an all plant-forward dining location, so students have the opportunity to get vegetarian, vegan options. We also wanted to make sure we were accommodating students that have dietary requests there. So it is also a made-without-gluten facility, and it is free of peanuts and tree nuts. So that location alone has an extensive salad bar. It has pizza, which is a gluten-free crust or a cauliflower crust, and a rotating kind of international hotline available. And it also has awesome desserts. So that's just one of our all-you-care-to-eats. We also have several a la carte locations. Some of those are things like IQ Fresh that has wraps and smoothies. We have a location over at Global Center called Core Plus that is a dedicated gluten-free facility, offering things like quesadillas, rice noodle bowls, and salads.
That gluten-free is really important, especially to educate people about gluten-free, but also those students and faculty and staff that like to have a gluten-free diet for either medical reasons or even just health reasons. It's a good and important option for them.
Yes, absolutely. One of the projects that we did last summer is we created a small kind of a micro grocery store available on campus. So Highland Market is now known as Highland Grocery, and it mm-hmm. offers a lot of fresh produce. It has an extensive bulk area, as well as grocery shopping opportunities for students so that they can take those items back to their dorm and prepare meals.
Do you work with the Student Health Services to work on the nutrition side of thing, to educate students about their healthy nutrition? And they have a pretty robust program. Do you work with them in concert with them on that?
We do work with Campus Health to ensure that they're aware of the options that are available on campus for students that they are counseling. And then we also have dining and nutrition educators available through dining services for students that have dietary requests and need to understand what's available for them.
So we talk about serving students, obviously, every day. There's students even during the summer or during the winter break, during fall and spring classes. There's people at the University of Arizona all the time. Even if some of the students leave for a little while and then come back, you're still serving food basically every single day, depending on the situation. And that's a pretty daunting thing. You're like a restaurant open all the time, and you have to serve people.
Yeah. That's right. And we really try and make sure that there's a good variety regardless of the number of students that are on campus. Obviously, summertime or winter closure, we do have a much lower census, but we do want to make sure that there's dining opportunities available for all.
For guys like Sixto and I, we enjoy going to, say, for instance, the President's Tailgate Party, right?
Yes, we do.
And we just kind of look at the food. We don't actually taste any of it, do we? We were laughing about we were laughing about our nutritional habits, especially at, and we were talking about all the folks that takes. But that's just an example. The tailgate parties at the University of Arizona, the student union is involved quite heavily in many of those, and the President's Tailgate Party, wherever it would be, is part of what you do. And it's amazing how you go from a cafeteria-style presentation or a grocery store, but then you also do catering and fine dining in the student union. I've been to a couple of events at the student union ballroom. Oh, my goodness, it rivals anything that you would get at a major a five-star resort. So
yeah, we have a very talented team, and we can do all things from the cafeteria, like you mentioned, to fine dining, express catering, from picking up coffee and bagels to white linen service and an extensive China meal.
Right. Well, I want to talk about something really, I think, is just unique. When the first time you see it, you're just like, what is that? And these are these little vehicles, the dining technology that delivers food from the student union over to different places on campus. You can tell us where they go, but the ones that I'm familiar with are ones that traveled to the Honors College, and they go under the bridge and they go across the street and they go right down to the Honors College. The student gets their food and turns around and comes back. So tell us about that technology that goes into delivery of food in that unique way.
Yeah, so we got the Rovers probably 2 or 3 years ago, and we wanted to be able to find a way to deliver food to students across campus, still having the locations that we have open available to everyone, but a way to get food to other areas of campus. And so we started, I think, with probably 20 Rovers, and we're up to about 50 now. The students love them. We see people that stop and take selfies with them or are walking with them, kind of like a pet. And it's a lot of fun to watch. We were ranked last year number 2 in the nation for the number of deliveries that we were able to offer. We did over 50,000 in 1 year. And basically, students just order via mobile app. They select that they want delivery, and it's delivered to the ADA accessible door at whatever building that they're asking for delivery. So we deliver to the dorms, we deliver to any building on campus, essentially.
So they can go anywhere that a person can go, then that little robot will go wherever they need to go to deliver that food.
That's right.
That's pretty right. Amazing. I will say that when you first see them, the first time you see them, it is an amazing experience. You like step back and go, what is that? And then someone kind of tells you what it is. But now that they've been on campus for, you know, they're almost just like anything else. Street furniture, whatever. People just kind of, it's just natural. Except for when somebody new comes on campus and then the selfies start going on.
Right.
And they are kind of cute, to be honest with you.
They are.
Cute.
They are. Their headlights are kind of look like eyes. And yeah. And they're a lot of fun. It's you can tell during move-in that students aren't really used to seeing those. And so that's a lot of fun for us to be able to offer those. It's a lot of fun to see them, you know, when there's five going at a time,
right.
And we'll watch the students that are loading them, and people will stop and take pictures of them just being loaded, so they're aware.
Are they as they travel? This is the interesting question that I've been thinking about. As they travel from the Student Union to say that I see them going to the Honors College, under the underpass there. Is there a human being that is piloting those somewhere, or are they all 100% autonomous and do it by themselves?
They're autonomous, but they can be taken over by a human. So there's actually, you can check to see on a dashboard where they are at all times.
Right. Well, it's kind of interesting when they get to the street. So Helen Street is right there. Once they come out of the underpass by the McClelland Hall there by the Eller College, they stop there at the street. And it's like when we were in elementary school and there was a crossing patrol where you wait, and once the traffic, then you proceed with caution across, and they start their flashing lights so that if there was a car that came, they would see them. And it's amazing how amazing they can transgress through all sorts of different kinds of ramps and streets and sidewalks. It's amazing. It is fascinating to see when you have never seen them before. And when you take a moment, I happened to be parked in a car and was waiting for something, and I just kind of watched them, about 10 of them, do this thing, and it's amazing the technology behind it.
Absolutely, and it's kind of the last technology that we've added to all of our other technology, things like kiosks, and the ability for pickup lockers across campus,
right.
Where a student can order essentially from their math class and go to the locker, scan a code, a locker lights up. The door opens and they're able to pick up their food.
That's really convenient. That's fantastic.
I've got to ask this question. Do these robots have a name?
They have numbers. We haven't named them.
I mean, R2-D2 has a name.
Yeah, that would be a cute little thing to give them all little names.
That would be.
Which one is, that could be a fun little project for to give them or have people adopt them. And they are cute as a button. And they're serving a purpose too. They're getting food to kids, and that's an important part of the convenience factor, which is amazing.
It's absolutely a convenience thing. And it was also a very nice thing during COVID, where if students weren't feeling well, it could be dropped, at that door so that they didn't have to go to a restaurant, even, you know, flu season, that type of thing,
right.
So that they can, you know, easily get food.
Right. That's amazing. Well, we're speaking with Christine Carlson. She's the Director of Dining and Nutrition at the University of Arizona Student Union's Memorial Center. Serving almost 5 million meals every year from that wonderful facility. And from small to how many people can fit in that large ballroom? 1,000 people maybe?
Probably. That's usually the Festival of Books dinner is
right.
In there, and that's usually about 900.
Yeah, it's amazing. I've been to that dinner, and it is amazing what you can get there. Well, that's really interesting. Thank you so much for joining us and telling us about all the good things that are going on for dining and nutrition, specifically nutrition. I think that's really important for students and parents who are listening, sending their kid down, that they're eating as well as they can. I'm sure there's times when they don't eat too well, but lots of them like to practice that good nutrition. So thank you for joining us this morning. So we're listening to Jump in Tucson on KVOI. You know, if you'd like to be interviewed on Jump in Tucson, check out jumpintucson.com. Maybe perhaps you or your organization, or if you're at the U of A, you might be interviewed live on Jump in Tucson. Thank you, Sixto, for being here this morning.
Thank you very much, Ed, for having me.
I think you and I ought to go down to the Student Union and check out some of those 30 restaurants. They have a new, what's it called, Cork and Craft. Cork and Craft, which is a little bit of a bar. It's up our alley. They've got a few things, adult beverages there that we could partake in, which is kind of nice. I was there. That was where I went to the promotion party. It was
pretty
cool.
It's a beautiful space.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Christine. Appreciate you being here today. And thank you all for listening to Jump in Tucson. We'll be back in just a minute with the second half. You're listening to Jump in Tucson on KVOI. Good things that are going on at the University of Arizona in research and student learning, student outcomes, and soon-to-be doctors in various fields. We've got one of those here, a graduate degree-seeking student who is going to be Dr. Shuli Chen here in about 30 days. So welcome, Dr. Chen, to be. We'll call you Dr. Chen today because you're going to be a doctor.
Thank you so much, Dad. Thanks so much for the invitation.
Thanks for coming. You're in the Ecology and Evolutionary Biology Department in the College of Science. And before we get to talk about when in drought in the Amazon, let's talk first about you and what brought you to the University of Arizona and your educational journey. So why are you at the University of Arizona, soon to become a doctor, a PhD in science, and why the U of A?
Actually, I was majoring in remote sensing when I was my undergraduate and master's, and then I developed algorithms for processing satellite data sets. And I thought that the process is kind of too technical. Then I realized, I want to explore something different. And I especially explore how the life on Earth works. And I want to explore the curiosity about nature and the interaction between the nature and the human activities. And that's why I kind of changed my major to the ecology and evolutionary biology and joined Selask Lab.
That's great. So you're in the Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology, and you're going to be a doctor and you're going to be a scientist. And what do you want to do once you complete your doctorate and maybe do some postdoc work? What are you looking to do? Will you stay here in the University of Arizona, or will you go somewhere else? What are your hopes?
I want to continue my study in Amazon forest conservation, especially explore the vulnerability on the climate change. So I will first do a short postdoc with my current advisor, mm-hmm. and then seeking to some other postdoc opportunities in other universities. Yeah, now I'm like in contact with a professor in MIT, and we're trying to write down a proposal to explore more interesting things.
So what postdoc work is so once you complete your doctorate, which will happen for you here, you'll defend in July and you'll be a doctor in midsummer. And then you go, what's postdoc is after you've received your degree, you continue to do the research. A lot of that typically is funded by a grant, depending on what you're doing, but typically you have applied for a grant, make a proposal, and you and your the co-partners and supervisors and so forth will make a grant, and then you'll get funded, and then you'll get to continue the research, similar to what you're doing as a doctoral researcher, but then it's called postdoc. It's after you've completed the degree, you're still doing the research to continue on, and that's what you're aiming for in the short term.
Yes, exactly. So like after my my PhD, I want to be explore more independent research.
Right.
Like right now, I'm kind of exploring the resilience and the vulnerability of the Amazon forest. Mm-hmm. It's more about the drought response. And in the future, I want to understand how the elevated CO2 concentration will affect the intrinsic of the forest tolerance to the climate change.
How did you get in when you were a little kid? When you were studying, how did you get interested in science, and then what led you to, we'll talk after the break about how you have been researching the Amazon forest, and how did you kind of say to yourself, I want to be a scientist, and I want to go to the University of Arizona, and I want to get a doctoral degree and become a scientist? What was that evolution in your own life? What caused you to do that?
That's a great question. It's kind of long story. At the beginning, I never dreamed to be a scientist. Uh-huh. But then once I, when I go to college, then I kind of feel like I always want to ask why questions. Mm-hmm. And then I kind of get bored when people always ask what this is. Of course, what this is important, but I always was driven by the science question about the mechanism and the why it happened in this way. And then I realized technical things is really helpful for me to do things, but this is not where my motivation is. So I kind of think, oh, what I can use this technology to do some applications. Then I kind of, my college advisor kind of guided me to the biology and the ecosystem. And right. Especially I attended a conference which is called the American Geophysical Union in 2016. And I met Scott there. And then he introduced me very interesting ecology studies in Sweden and Amazon. I got totally intrigued at that time. So right. that's why I was determined to apply for UA. And especially in our department has a long reputation about study in ecology and the ecosystem ecology. And especially I still feel appreciated because Scott gave me an offer, like a student like me has right. no background in biology, but just has a huge interest in ecology and evolution.
You know, we started this show called Jump in Tucson on this radio station for that very reason, to talk on Mondays about wonder, about the good things that are going on at the University of Arizona. Your story is a good story about how a student who is kind of just deciding what to be
yes.
kind of flips a switch and look at you. You're going to be a doctor of in ecology. You're going to be a PhD. You're going to defend your dissertation. You're going to be going to do some postdoc, possibly at MIT, but maybe at some other institution. And you're going to, once a wildcat, always a wildcat. And we've launched a career here at the University of Arizona for a new scientist. And I think that's a really powerful story for you know, what we do at the University of Arizona. And so you're a living embodiment of that.
Yes.
So do you have responsibilities at the Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology? Are you teaching any classes? Are you a graduate assistant anywhere? Are you helping out in the teaching realm, or are you just strictly doing research?
I had like 3 years in work as a teaching assistant,
uh-huh.
like the introduction of the biology and uh-huh. the biomath and the global change.
So the young people that are just starting out their undergraduate career in science, you're helping them kind of get excited about it. When you become a teacher's assistant, you're assisting the full professor, whether an associate or assistant professor, with teaching these large sections of students who are just getting started in their undergraduate. Usually, typically in their second semester, their sophomore year, or their first semester, their junior year is when they start taking the majority of their major classes. And so as a teacher assistant, you're helping large classes and grading lots of papers probably, right?
Yes, yes. One of the most exciting moments for me is the office hour. There I made a lot of motivated students. They are interested in ecology and science.
Yeah, you talk about when you met your Scott, your advisor, at a conference in 2016, and he inspired you to go on to what you're doing now and become a doctor and become a scientist. As a TA and doing office hours with undergraduates, that's one of the great things that you have the opportunity to do, is to share with students your story and get them excited and get them pumped up for their undergraduate or graduate degree, depending on where they are. Mm-hmm. And that's a really important part of the process of education, is sharing that story with those that are coming behind you.
I wish I inspired them.
Oh, I'm sure you did. Well, just your story alone, coming over to America and jumping in with, no pun intended, but I guess a pun intended, jumping in and getting involved and becoming a doctor of ecology and evolutionary biology in the College of Science is a powerful thing. So you've spent a lot of the last 3, 4, or 5 years working on, almost 8 years, focusing on the Amazon. And so when we come back after the break, what we'll do is we'll talk a little bit about the article that was in UA News recently, When in Drought, Researchers Map Which Parts of the Amazon Are Most Vulnerable. And so we'll go into your research and what you're defending your dissertation on, which is ecology and the Amazon forest and how important that is to our whole entire ecosystem of the world and why the Amazon is so important. We'll be back after the break. You're listening to Jump in Tucson on KVOI 1030 AM, The Voice. We'll be back in just a minute with Shuli Chen, soon-to-be doctor at the University of Arizona, and we'll talk about the Amazon forest. Welcome back to Jump in Tucson. This is the Monday Wonder Edition, where we talk about the good things going on at the University of Arizona. With us today is the soon-to-be Dr. Shuli Chen. She is now a graduate degree-seeking student, soon to be a PhD in ecology and evolutionary biology in the College of Science. Welcome back.
Thank you, Ed.
Your research has been focused on the Amazon forest, and a recent article in UA News was "When in Drought, Researchers Map Parts of the Amazon That Are Most Vulnerable to Climate Change." And so, the Amazon is huge. How big is the Amazon? If we were to kind of equate that to kind of understand how big it is it as big as, like, say, the state of Arizona? Is it a pretty big place?
It's actually twice the size of India, and it's the largest largest rainforest in the world, and it's also the largest continuous forest in the world.
Right, and it goes kind of horizontally. It goes top to bottom, vertically, if you look at a globe, but it stretches across all of South America at the kind of the midsection there in the top, and it's huge.
Yes.
And the Amazon River is the largest river in the world. The biggest flow of water in the world is the Amazon River.
Yes, it is the largest river, and discharging a lot of water into the ocean, which is more than the largest next rivers combined.
Wow, all the rest of the rivers combined don't put as much water in as the Amazon.
Exactly.
The other thing that I thought was interesting in your research was, or that what you pointed out, was that the Amazon flows basically from west to east into the Gulf there and out into the ocean. But going the opposite direction is a even three times bigger than that is the what's called the atmospheric river, which is up above the Amazon River.
Yes.
And it's taking three times as much water the opposite direction over to the east. And that's a pretty important thing, because this is the water is coming from these geysers, they call it, from the trees that are emitting vapor into the air. So it's pretty, that water system is really important to the forest, correct?
Yeah, it is a very powerful hydrological system, especially like the Amazon forest, like bring the water, recycled water to the atmospheric river, which is in the opposite direction. And all this composite together is make the whole system very complex and very influential.
Very important, even affects the weather here in the United States. You know, over the last 20 years, there have been four massive droughts in the Amazon. The years are 2005, 2010, 2015, and 16. And then even in 2023, there was another one. What is the cause of these droughts? Why do droughts happen in a place like the Amazon, which has this huge river and this atmospheric river? Why do droughts happen in this cyclical way that they do?
I think a simple question is because of the global warming, and that there is increased the frequency of drought. But the more specific reason is the abnormal increased sea surface temperature. Like for example, the 2005 and 2010 drought, it's because the abnormal increased the sea surface temperature from the Atlantic Ocean. But for the 2015 and 16 El Nino and the current one, they are caused by the Pacific equatorial sea surface temperature.
So when that, as that temperature rises on the sea surface, then it causes the ecosystem or the water system to maybe differentiate itself in different parts of the forest, and then there that means that there's drought in some places and not as much water and the atmospheric river. So it's kind of a very, as you said, very complicated system. But when the heat on the oceans rise, then it affects what happens on the land over the. So how come, very interesting, that some trees actually turn greener in the Amazon during a drought, and some die, obviously, if they don't get the water. Why is it they're differentiating? What, you would think that in a drought that all the plants would die, but in the Amazon you've discovered that actually some of them actually green up and become perhaps more healthy in a drought system. And why is that?
Yes, that's some of the motivation that I start this study. So we kind of observe the positive response in the 2005 drought, but people also observe the increased mortality in the field sites. So we wonder what is the gap knowledge to make this such a different phenomenon. So then I was looking at the very local environment, and So in the typical conditions, the shallow water table forest, their roots are actually are submerged in water, mm-hmm. which limits their access to the oxygen. And right. in this way, this will limit the growth. But during the drought, the water recedes, but does not really go away. So they still have good access to the water, but at the same time, they have more access to their oxygen. So they will do better respiration and their growth. And in that case, that they will tend to have positive response to the drought with extra sunlight because of less cloudy during right. drought.
That's an interesting juxtaposition that less water causes the roots and the trees to have more oxygen, which then turns them greener,
exactly.
which actually makes them look healthier. And you've studied 21 years worth of data. You had some colleagues from Brazil and the United Kingdom. And, you know, obviously we all kind of know this, that there's a tremendous amount of carbon trapped in the forest. So what happens if these trees, which are massive, twice the size of India, in South America, if these trees are cut down, cleared, or die, you know, what happens to that carbon?
Yeah, that's a very serious question. The very obvious direct consequence is that we lost one of the largest carbon sinks. So basically, we add more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and in this way, the global warming will become worse. And that's the direct consequence. But there is another even more influential and consequence is about the large scale hydroclimates. Like for example, the mid-southern latitude tended to be a desert, like mm-hmm. the Australia and
right.
the Africa, but the South America is actually all rainforest. It's because of the Amazon basin and because of the Andeans, and the water evaporates from the ocean, from the Atlantic, and the wind carries the water to the forest.
That atmospheric river that we talked about?
Yes, yeah. exactly. And the trees absorb the water and then move it up through the vines, trunks, and stems, and emit back to the atmosphere. And in that case, so this is actually the grand scale phenomenon. It's not just for one trees. And that how this the forest brings to the feed the atmospheric river and then make the whole system very complex and influential, and this also act so the atmospheric river also act as the breadbasket of the largest agricultural region of Brazil. So if we lose the forest, it's not just about the forest; it's more about the vast region associated in this whole system. So that it threatens the integrity of the whole world system.
That's amazing. Well, Dr. Shuli Chen, who is going to be Dr. Chen here in a few weeks, congratulations on your research and the published articles that you've had so far. Good luck to you on your postdoc research as you again explore the Amazon and what an important thing it is. As we leave, I'll just have you comment on this final quote from your article, which was in UA News, which is an important resource for information. It says, if we care about preserving biodiversity, conserving valuable ecosystems, conserving valuable forests, knowing this kind of information about the Amazon is important. And that's why you've done what you've done, right?
Yes. Thank you so much, Ed.
Okay, thank you for being with us. You're listening to Jump in Tucson, the Wonder Edition. Good things going on at the University of Arizona, and the soon-to-be Dr. Shuli Chen. She's one of those good things that's happening at the University of Arizona. So thank you for being with us today. I thank you all for listening. If you'd like to be on Jump in Tucson, go to AckerleyAdvertising.com or JumpinTucson.com and send us a note, and we'll be happy to have you on the air. This is Jump in Tucson on KVOI 1030 AM, The Voice.